Save big on everything for your next staining project when you shop at Menards. Transform your home in one weekend with exterior stain and sealer from Dutch Boy. It provides one coat protection on decks, fences, siding, and outdoor furniture, and repels rain after just 4 hours of application. That means quicker results, saving you both time and money. Check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big money
at Menards. You know that feeling when you're about to score 30% off, but they want your number? Ugh. Give them your Line 2 number instead. It's a second line on your phone, perfect for nabbing promo codes without inviting spam to your party. Sign up for every discount under the sun, then block the junk texts that follow. You get all the perks, but none of the spammy baggage. More codes, less chaos. Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store and get your shopping sidekick today. Because the only thing blowing up your phone should be good deals.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra-titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time. For water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates. Not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
Astonishing Legends Network.
Hey, everybody. So glad you're back. I've got a couple of announcements before we start the episode. Tonight's episode is Phone Calls from the Dead. And I did something a little different that I usually don't do. I have posted a PDF of the entire book on the website. Okay, it's under the show notes for this episode. The reason I did it was this. The book is no longer in print. Any copy you buy is going to be a used copy, and the used copies are insanely expensive. So I know that a lot of you do like to read the book, so what I've done is I've gone ahead, I've posted the PDF. There's a link to it in the show notes. Let me tell you how to get to it. By the way, there are show notes for every single episode, okay, that includes pictures and links. Here's how you get there. Go to our website, richardhaddamsparanormalbookshelf.com, and the first page that shows up, click on View All Episodes, all right? And then you can scroll down through the episodes, find the one you want, and click on the button that says Listen Now. The episode won't start playing. It'll just take you to the description and the show notes, which are photographs and little links and stuff that I have for things I talk about, the books, but then other things that I talk about you can find. So take a look there, find the PDF, check it out, okay? So that's one thing. And the other thing is, you know, we're coming up on the holiday season, so as long as you're at the website, go to the upper right-hand corner and click on Shop Exclusive Merch. And then just scroll down on that link and you'll see pictures of mugs and tote bags and hoodies and all kinds of cool stuff. So, you know, I mean, I know you probably don't know anyone who wants any of this stuff, but I know you do. So make it easy. Buy it for yourself. Wrap it up. Give it to yourself. Or give it to somebody who owes you a present. Either at a gift exchange, at a party, at a family thing. Just make it easy. Your husband, your wife, your kids. Just, hey, here's what I want. I've wrapped it up. Hand it to them. Just, you know, put a tag on it. Put it under the tree. And we're done. That's how Susan and I do it nowadays. I typically buy everything that I want. I wrap it up. I write a lovely note from her to me. And on Christmas morning, guess what? Everybody's happy. All right. I think that's all I needed. Oh, one last thing. The next show in 2 weeks on December 9th is going to be a bonus episode. And it's sort of a little example of Patreon content. It's what we do on Patreon. So if you're not there, this is a little taste of what we do there. And in this case, it's going to be an interview with Farah Erdozu, who wrote Love in an Alien Purgatory. And that was from season one. Anyway, she is located in Istanbul, and we end up talking about Turkey and that region and the supernatural events that take place there, alien abductions, UFOs. It's different than here. which I find amazing. I love hearing about how these events play out in other cultures. We talk about all that. It's a great conversation. She's an amazing person. So next time around in 2 weeks, December 9th, check out that episode. If it seems cool to you, come on and join us on Patreon. I think that's it. All right. I hope you enjoy this week's episode. Here we go. Phone Calls from the Dead by D. Scott Rogo and Raymond Bayless. We're here today to talk about one of my favorite books, Phone Calls from the Dead by D. Scott Rogo and Raymond Bayless, Prentice Hall, 1979. But before we do, I want to tell you how I first found the book way back in the summer of 1983. And to tell you that story, I have to tell you about my friend Larry Gonzalez. And I also have to tell you about how I lost my virginity. During the spring of 1983, I was, if you'll remember, just starting to date Michelle Goodwin. And my friend Larry Gonzalez was making some progress with Stacey Neals. As things got more and more serious between Michelle and I, Larry was my reality check. His casually pornographic questions about how things were progressing with Michelle and myself made me laugh and kept me grounded. And that was important because things were moving fast. The road was getting slippery, and though I would never have admitted it, I was having some trouble handling the curves. We were going to have sex. Me and Michelle, not me and Larry. That much was clear. We decided it wouldn't be on prom night. Too cliche. But in retrospect, I'm pretty proud that it was something we talked about and planned for. The planning went like this. Michelle told her mom she was thinking of having sex with me. So her mom took her to the doctor. And then Michelle explained to her doctor that she had a boyfriend and was planning to have sex with him. So her doctor talked with her about sexually transmitted diseases and various methods of birth control. And then they decided on one, a diaphragm, and he prescribed it for her. And that was it. See how that works? The only downside to the mature, mindful approach to losing my virginity is that it gave me a little too much time to think about it. I wanted our first time to be special, magical, perfect. At the time, I was obsessed with the idea of endurance. For some reason, I was convinced that sexual intercourse had to last at least an hour, or she wouldn't, you know, go to Disneyland. This was probably something I'd read in the Playboy Advisor. Larry always had a few copies of Playboy stashed around. Anyway, the night it finally happened, we were well into the 45-minute zone, and I was focusing hard on restructuring the fourth act of my A-team script, when she said something along the lines of, "You about through?" Fuck, now he's gonna ruin our first time by going too long? Great. I quickly changed tactics and focused on finishing. I conjured an image I was sure would work. Me selling my A-team script. Hey, it had worked in the past. But by now, I'd somehow gone numb. Was our first time really going to end without anyone going to Disneyland? I was starting to panic when she whispered something in my ear, and I started to laugh, and then a few seconds later, let's just say I was at the happiest place on earth. That was late June. My plan had been to finish my script by graduation day, and I did, but just barely. At all the graduation parties, the conversations were the same. "Oh my God, Michelle, you're going to Yale! Are you excited about Yale? When do you leave for Yale?" Michelle was a year ahead of me, so while she was getting ready to leave for college, I still had a year of high school to go. And the Yale thing was getting me down. It was cool, and I was happy for her, but something about it distressed me deeply. I think it was because there was no way for me to encompass it. It felt beyond me, beyond my control. It would soon become the biggest thing in her life, and right now I was that thing. But my time was running short. The longer the summer went on, and the more we had sex, and the deeper we fell in love, the weirder it got. It was like we were simultaneously on two tracks going in opposite directions. We were getting closer and preparing to separate. This felt unsustainable. And of course it was. The smart move would have been to simply enjoy a summer of first love and say goodbye and move on with our lives. Or even better, break up immediately and not draw things out. But neither one of us wanted to do that. What we had felt big and real and important. We wanted to keep it going. Larry and I fell into a routine that summer. On Sundays, we'd have lunch at Numero Uno Pizza. We'd get the fried mozzarella loaf, and we'd each get one of their individual pizzas with the sweet dough that tasted like cornbread. Mine was always pineapple and pepperoni. Larry's was always sausage. It was the day after Michelle and I had done it. It felt so monumental, like history-making. And the whole morning before seeing Larry, I totally assumed I would tell him immediately. But once we sat in the booth, I didn't. I wasn't sure why. Larry and I pretty much shared everything, but I found that I wasn't ready. I wanted to keep this to myself for a minute, just kind of live with it a while before putting it out there in the world. So we talked about other stuff and ate pizza. Then we headed to Poobah's on the corner of Wilson and Walnut in Pasadena. Poobah's was heaven. It was an old house that had been mostly gutted and then refilled with crates of used, rare, imported, and vintage records. It's where I found my first bootleg Talking Heads album and a Japanese EP of Devo's Are We Not Men? We Are Devo, printed on bright red vinyl, just like their hats. But I was done looking before Larry, so I hung out on the ratty couch by the door and dug through a small shelf of cast-off paperbacks, a kind of retail afterthought, like a rack of discount country western CDs at a lonely highway gas station. But this week I made a real find. A practically brand new paperback with a title so lurid I almost thought it was a joke. Phone Calls from the Dead. I flipped it over and read the back. It was exactly what the title implied. The authors, D. Scott Rogo and Raymond Bayless, had apparently conducted a, quote, two-year investigation into this incredible phenomenon. This book was going to set me back 95 cents. But to be honest, folks, I would have paid twice that. I had to have this book. Quick aside, I wish I'd kept that copy because it is almost unfindable now. I'm talking about the paperback, and if you do find it, it's currently selling for well over $100. A first edition hardback is going to run you anywhere from $500 to $2,000. This is a title that is definitely due for a reprint. So, what are we talking about when we talk about Phone Calls from the Dead? Oh, my friend, sit down. This is the stuff of urban legend, except it's true. You want to hear one? Let me tell you one. There's only one way to tell stories like this, so here goes. So this guy named John Medved, who was a doctor in Los Angeles in 1974... his mom dies. Okay, so he goes to Idaho where she's being buried and he gets home a few days later. And the next morning, it's just normal morning, and he's in the bathroom brushing his teeth when the phone rings. So he goes to answer it. And when he does, all he hears is this voice going,
Johnny.
And he's all like, what? But the voice just keeps going,
Johnny.
And now he's getting freaked out, right? So he's all like, who is this? And then the voice says,
is that you, Johnny dear?
And he goes like ice cold because he thinks someone's fucking with him because the voice, it sounds real familiar. So he goes all high pitched like, who is this? And then the voice on the phone goes, so this is a true story, and John Medved was a real guy, an actual physician living and working in Los Angeles, and the authors interviewed him in person in 1977. And to be clear, I'm not making fun of the guy or the call. I honestly find these accounts completely terrifying. Less horrific than, say, alien abductions, but somehow cooler and way more fun than just seeing a ghost. I had just finished reading Susie Smith's EVP book, Voices of the Dead, so this felt like suddenly coming upon its spiritual sequel. The dead are still talking, but this time it's personal. But this phenomenon was actually quite different from EVP. Trickier, scarier. With EVP, you are reaching out into the darkness. You are casting your line into dark waters. There's some personal agency in that, but what happens when something rises up from those dark waters and casts its line toward you? That's very different. And let's not forget, back then, every time you picked up the phone, you were to some extent casting your fate to the wind. Now, if you were born after 1985, you probably don't have the same relationship to the telephone as those of us who grew up earlier. I'm talking about a landline, of course. It was our main connection to the outside world, and it was charged with more emotion than any other machine in your house. TV and radio talked at you, but the phone opened up two-way communication. And since there was no visual component, the human voice became incredibly important. Children were not allowed to answer the phone in their home until they were old enough to employ certain etiquette. Like, Haddam Household, this is Richard speaking. The ring of a landline phone was always harsh and thrilling. It was a sound that aroused excitement and fear. It heralded something unknown. Who's calling our house? And why? Depending on what was happening in your life, any given phone call had the capacity to deliver the best or worst news you might ever hear. You almost always learned about the death of a loved one from a phone call. If you were a teenager, every time that phone rang, it meant at least the theoretical possibility that your world might be expanding. A friend, a boy or a girl, was reaching out to you with an invitation, maybe an opportunity. If you were a little older, a ringing phone could mean money. You got the job. Or, can you cover my shift? Or it could mean the opposite. Your rent is late. The check bounced. We need our money. But either way, you had to pick up. And you had absolutely no idea who you would be talking to. Phone answering machines didn't become common until the late 1980s. There was no such thing as screening your calls. If the phone rang and you didn't pick up, it just kept on ringing and ringing, accusing you, begging you, insisting you answer it like some hideous mechanical crying baby. Pick me up! Pick me up! If you didn't, for whatever reason, you found yourself frozen, just staring at the phone in terror until it finally stopped ringing. And there is nothing louder in the world than the echoing silence of a landline telephone that has just stopped ringing. For me, there was already so much anxiety and fear wrapped up in answering the phone. Now you're telling me it might be a dead person calling? Yeah, that tracks. For a phenomenon so rare and elusive, Rogo and Bayliss's book is packed with stories of supernatural phone calls, most of them extremely recent when the book was published in 1979. You could absolutely imagine receiving one of them. In fact, the odds were pretty good that the phone in your house would ring while you were reading the book. Mine did twice. I remember specifically. Once it was my friend Herb, and once it was my friend Tim. And when I told them what I was reading, they both said the same thing. But Rich, I am dead. The first person to read my completed A-Team script was my dad. He watched the show with me, but I didn't even notice this until maybe the fifth time he did it. I'd go into the living room to spend the most important hour of my week absorbing and analyzing every last second of that week's episode. We didn't have a VCR, so I couldn't record the episodes for later study. I had to imprint them on my soul on first viewing. And I did. And for some reason, my dad sat silently on the couch and watched too. Maybe now is the time to tell you that for the first 35 years of my life, I always watched television while sitting in a wooden rocking chair, rocking and rocking and rocking like an insane person. It was almost physically impossible for me to watch television any other way. I had to be moving. My father and I never talked about the A-Team. We didn't really talk about anything, certainly not about anything that mattered. But I had him read my script because he was the only person in my family who had seen the show and would be able to tell me if I had captured it. And there was another reason. I wanted to announce to him, in the plainest way possible, who I was now and who I intended on being. After he read my 65-page masterpiece, there could be no doubt about what I was going to do with the rest of my life. I wanted him to be impressed, if not with the script, then with my commitment. And it was a safe move, too, because my dad was not a creative guy. There was no way anything he said about the quality of the script could hurt me. As it turned out, his only complaints were about logic things, like how easily the characters found parking spots and how you couldn't really drive from Long Beach to downtown Los Angeles in 30 minutes. My dad was an administrator at the Los Angeles Unified School District, and he had access to an industrial-sized copier. He told me he could make as many copies of my script as I wanted, and for the next 5 years, until he retired, he did exactly that. It was a way for him to partner with me and help me with my career. And most important to my dad, it was also a way to save money. Hey, everyone's got a skill set. I always thought that since I was actually, you know, writing the scripts, that my skill set was more valuable than his. But years later, I've come to realize that my dad's saving money skill set was something I should have worked on a little harder. Still, I wanted to start getting paid for my efforts immediately. So, on the morning of July 5th, 1983, I started typing out 93 separate query letters to 93 different literary agencies, all listed in the back of J. Michael Straczynski's Complete Book of Scriptwriting. Each one had to be individually written on a separate piece of paper on my mother's IBM Selectric electric typewriter, which is where I wrote the script itself. And as soon as I was done writing those letters, I had to get 93 business-sized envelopes and address them all on the typewriter, plus my return address, and then put all those letters into all those envelopes and stamp all 93 of them and then mail them. It took me 11 8-hour days to do this. I was a slow typist, but I felt so professional typing up those letters, so legit, like a real writer. Each one felt like a lottery ticket, and I just knew that I was on the verge of winning my jackpot. That whole summer was like a dream. Friday nights were for my friends, Tim, Larry, and Herb. We'd see movies, sometimes new stuff, but just as often Tim would haul us out to the New Art in Santa Monica to see stuff we'd never heard of before, things like William Richard's Winter Kills or Billy Wilder's 1-2-3 or Peter Medak's The Ruling Class starring Peter O'Toole. Then we'd end up back at my place and watch MTV until I fell asleep in my rocking chair and they all quietly left. But Saturdays were for Michelle. For me, a date meant dinner and a movie, and we did that a lot. But a lot of times we'd just end up driving and talking for hours. Great loping drives down any street just to see where it would lead. the radio playing song after song, and each one I loved more than the last. It was the soundtrack of my summer of 83. Shock the Monkey, Let's Dance, She Blinded Me with Science, Stepping Out, Goody Two Shoes, Come Dancing, White Wedding, Sweet Dreams, and best of all, the one that still gives me chills, Our House. One night we started driving south on Atlantic Boulevard in Alhambra and didn't stop until the street ended 26 miles later in Long Beach. We had no idea. We parked and got out and walked across the cold sand until we could say we had made it all the way to the ocean. We looked out at the lights of Shoreline Village and the Queen Mary. Supposedly haunted, I told her. We held hands. The foggy night sky was glowing orange with the harbor lights, like we were underneath a giant carnival tent that went up and up forever. It felt like magic. We'd come so far. But after a few minutes, we both decided to take the freeway back to her house. It was only 10:30. The night was still young. And you know, we had other plans. And if you're wondering, my dad was right. Even without traffic, it took at least 45 minutes to drive from Long Beach to downtown LA. By July 18th, the day I mailed off my letters to all those agents, my soul had reached a point of blissful contentment. For the first time in my life, I felt fed. I felt safe. I felt loved. I had a girlfriend. We were sleeping together a lot. Plus, now I was a TV writer. I'd written an actual script. I had everything I'd ever wanted. But as George Bernard Shaw once said, man can climb to the highest summits, but he cannot dwell there long. Now, I didn't know it at the time, but D. Scott Rogo was a bit of a child prodigy himself. He had published his first book in the field of parapsychology at age 19. And by the time he died at age 40, he had authored 25 books and edited 4 others. When Rogo was in his late 20s, he and Raymond Bayless began their one-of-a-kind investigation when they realized they had both anecdotally heard about phantom phone call cases and decided to investigate further. From the book, quote, "Our work has taught us to be totally open-minded, though at all times skeptical. We've learned through long and hard experience never to reject anybody's story about a personal psychic experience or encounter without first giving it a fair hearing. Why? Because some of the craziest stories we've investigated have turned out to be absolutely authentic." The first phantom phone call story I told you was pretty crazy, but this next one is even crazier. Here's what happened. One Sunday evening in May of 1971, Bonnie and C.E. McConnell received a phone call from an elderly friend of theirs, Enid Johnson. Now, Enid had been in declining health over the past year and had been transferred from one nursing facility to another. At this point, the McConnells had lost touch with her, and it had been months since they'd spoken, so they were delighted when Enid called. Over the course of the 30-minute phone call, they both spoke with her, and they reminisced about old times. What they both specifically recall is how good she sounded. Quote, "like the Enid of 20 years ago." Enid herself remarked more than once,
"I've never been happier."
They asked if she was being treated well where she was, and she assured them,
"I've never had such good care."
Bonnie asked if she had a phone right by the bed, as she always preferred, but Enid said she didn't. Bonnie was surprised. Quote, "Do you mean you can get up and go to the phone?" To which Enid replied,
"I get around just fine."
A few days later, Bonnie decided to check on Enid again, so she called the nursing home and asked for Enid's room, but the operator was taken aback. Enid was no longer in that room. She passed away the previous Sunday at 10:30 in the morning, about 7 hours before she called her friends. They confirmed all the details of the call and double-checked the time of death. There was no question. Enid was dead at the time they had that conversation. Now, this case led Rogo and Bayless to one of their first conclusions about these sorts of cases, which, as it turns out, are not rare. When the call recipient was unaware of the caller's death, the calls tended to last longer. Another case like it is stranger still, a phone call to the dead. A New Jersey woman named Marie Delisio had a disturbing dream about a childhood friend of hers named Lana, and in the dream, Lana was sinking into a pool of blood. Marie was so disturbed by the dream that she called her friend the next day. It had been almost a year since they'd spoken, but Lana picked up immediately and they had a more or less normal conversation. Lana told her she'd been in the hospital recently and said she was due to go back the very next day. A few days after that, thinking her friend would be back home by now, Marie called Lana again, only to be shocked when Lana's husband answered the phone and told her that Lana had been dead for 6 months. As you read through these stories, an unspoken feature begins to emerge. There is no urgent message being related. The calls aren't warnings, and except for a couple of cases, no useful information is imparted. There are some in which it's clear that the dead, like Stevie Wonder, just called to say I love you. But for the overwhelming majority of cases, pointlessness almost seems to be the point. Which, of course, leaves us with only one possible explanation. The dead are calling us just to show us that they can. But how are they pulling it off? Well, the authors narrow it down to two basic theories. One, the calls are originating from some remote location and then are routed to the recipient's home in the normal way through a local central telephone exchange. Or two, they are somehow created within the instrument itself, which means, of course, the calls are coming from inside the house, even inside the phone, inside the earpiece, to be precise. In a way, that's not a crazy theory. After all, it's not really your voice that people hear on a phone, it's an electronically rearranged version of your voice. If spirits can manipulate electricity, then they should be able to do this too. So, which method are the ghosts using? Well, according to Rogo and Bayless, it's both. An example of the latter, an inside-the-phone case, is one that occurred in a San Francisco hotel room. The witness was awakened at 5:30 a.m. by her room phone ringing. She answered it and heard the sound of her aunt's voice calling for her. But then the call seemed to simply end. No click, no eventual dial tone, just silence. The woman hung up, then called the hotel operator to see if she could be reconnected with whoever had just called. But the operator told her that no calls had been put through to any room in the past 5 hours. The only way any call could have arrived in any room was through the hotel operator. 3 hours later, the phone rang again. This time, it was the woman's husband calling to report that her aunt had died at 5:30 that morning. This case seems to indicate pretty clearly that it was the phone itself that was being manipulated by whoever or whatever made that first call. Another logical question is, why the phone? Think of it this way. The woman in the San Francisco hotel was asleep when the phone rang. It was ostensibly her aunt somehow trying to let her know she had just died. Well, why not simply appear in her niece's dreams? Wouldn't that have been easier? Rogo and Bayless suggest that because phone communication was so ubiquitous in the 1960s and 70s, that it might be nothing more than force of habit. And for most of the people who receive such a call, it turns out that the phone was the primary mode of contact they had with the person while they were still alive. So maybe it's just the deep human urge to connect that somehow results in these extreme long-distance calls. I had mailed off my 93 agent letters on July 18th. Six of my letters came back unopened. The agencies were no longer in business or no longer at that address. The phone calls began the very next day, July 19th, the day after I mailed the letters. Apparently, the U.S. Postal Service really rocks. Also, apparently, some people just couldn't wait to tell me that they didn't want to read my script. I got three calls that first day, each one thanking me for my letter, but informing me that they were not reading any unsolicited material. Nor were they taking on any new clients. That was Tuesday. More calls came in the next day, all of them with bad news. By Thursday, answering the phone began to feel like lining up to get kicked in the balls. And yet, one of those calls might be different. One of them might be what I wanted. An agent saying, "We were thrilled to receive your letter. We've been waiting for a high school kid to write an A-team script. With you, our prayers have been answered." This is rejection, I thought. This is what everyone's been warning me about since I was a little kid and said I wanted to be an actor. It's a hard life, they'd say. There's a lot of rejection. Now, the people saying this were mostly my parents and aunts and uncles who were all teachers with the LA Unified School District. What the fuck did they know about show business? I have no idea who schooled them up, but they all said the same thing to me. And every time they did, all I could think was, "You don't think I get my ass rejected every day already?" Teachers, girls, bullies, the normals, even my parents. What do you think my life is? Were they that blind? Well, of course they were. I blinded them. I pretended to be happy. I pretended to have my shit together. Hey, look at me. I'm a great actor already. Getting rejected by Hollywood was part of the process of eventually getting accepted by Hollywood. Bring it on. I got letters too. Those were less brutal. Plus, it was kind of cool because, you know, mail. Real nice, creamy stationery with fancy raised letterheads. All telling me, "No thank you." Rejection letters. I saved them all. I have them still. The phone calls continued throughout the following week. Every time I picked up the phone, I tightened up to withstand the blow. And pretty soon I began to enjoy taking the punches. It made me feel strong. It's just a phone call, I thought. They can't really hurt me. And they can't make me stop. Do they think I'm going to stop? I'm not going to stop. On Friday of the second week, July 29th, I received two letters on the same day. Both of them asking to read my script. I couldn't believe it. They wanted to read my script. I'd almost forgotten that good news was a possibility. Absorbing pain into my body without collapsing had become my only focus. These were my acceptance letters. The Calder Agency and the Lynn Plachette Agency. As far as I was concerned, the hard part was over. Once they read my script, there was no question in my mind that they would take me on as a client, or at the very least, send my script to Stephen J. Cannell Productions. My plan was working. So, I sent my script off to both of the two agencies who requested it, and then I took a breath, looked around, and realized that the summer was almost over. The reality of Michelle leaving for college began to take form. Now, I hate to sound like the oldest man alive, but you have to remember, when people left town back then, that was kind of it. No texting, no emails, no social media. They really left and you really missed them, they were gone. If you could afford long distance, you could talk on the phone. Other than that, you could write letters. We weren't in the future yet. We were close, so close, but not quite. She was going to leave. I would be alone. It was going to hurt like a motherfucker. And I didn't have anything going on in my life to take the sting off the fact that she was moving forward, and I was not. A week before she left, we drove out to visit her dad. He lived deep in Canoga Park in one of those two-story open courtyard apartment complexes, centered around a kidney-shaped swimming pool and surrounded with miniature palm trees sunk into big cement planters. It had to be 109 degrees that day, but as usual, his apartment was dark and cold and smelled like an ashtray. And everywhere, on every surface, in every room, in stacks that went above my head, were paperback books. I loved this place. We'd been there a couple times before. Her dad scared me to death, but the books, that's where we connected. When I say connected, what I mean is I'd wander around, pawing through them, and take whatever I wanted. I'd leave with a grocery sack full of books. Her dad was a small guy, mostly bald, with glasses, and some kind of denture deal that made him talk with a sort of clenched jaw that always made him sound pissed off. Or maybe he was just always pissed off. I was a skinny kid, but I still outweighed him by 20 pounds. Didn't matter, I had no doubt that he could kill me. He talked about it all the time. "You do anything to my daughter, I'll kill you." He said it with a smile, like it was a joke, but he had the smile of a reptile. "Gun, knife, bare hands, doesn't matter. They taught me all of them." They. He never said who they were. I guess I was just supposed to know. Then he'd laugh and I'd laugh, so we had fun. He took us out to lunch that day at one of a handful of Vietnamese restaurants he'd go to where he knew the family that ran it, knew all their names, their kids' names, the names of their parents, the grandparents, and somehow he ate for free at all of these places. He introduced us to Vietnamese food that summer, which was still not a super common thing in Los Angeles in the early 1980s. As we were finishing lunch, he fished a book out of my grocery bag and held it up. It was called The Other Side by Bishop James A. Pike. "Start with this one," he said. "It's incredible, but it's not for everyone." That night, in bed, after sex, Michelle and I had a difficult conversation. It was about the possibility of one of us sleeping with someone else while we were apart. We conceded that it was a real possibility, and if it happened, we'd tell the other one, and it all felt very mature and adult, but to be honest, I didn't think it was a possibility, not for me at least. For her, I just wasn't sure. For me to have sex, I would have to go out with the clear intention of sleeping with someone and then somehow make that happen, which felt impossible, even then, lying in bed with someone I'd just had sex with. But at the time, I thought that for her, it would be much simpler. After all, she was a girl. Guys would want to have sex with her, and if she wanted to, all she had to do was let him. I know that it was and always has been more complicated than that, but at the time, I didn't really know. Still, I had to factor in that she'd be in a new place, a romantic, historic, legendary college campus in New England. I mean, the whole point of going to Yale was to give yourself over to it, immerse yourself in the experience of being at Yale, being a Yalie. That's what you were paying for. It would be a huge part of her life forever. The Yale class of 1987. The things that she and her new friends did would be the stories they would tell for the rest of their lives. And I would not be a part of any of it. How was I supposed to compete with that? Her family was already stocking up on Yale sweatshirts and mugs. It was like they were all going to Yale. And I was beginning to hate Yale. Not Yale specifically, I guess, but everything it stood for. I was never a joiner. I never found value or comfort or self-esteem in being part of anything larger than myself. Mostly because from a young age, I was never welcomed into groups, so I didn't trust them. For my first day of school, I was an outsider. For survival's sake, I had no choice but to embrace it and turn my differences into self-perceived strengths. I convinced myself that I was better than everyone. But was I? More and more, it was looking like I was worse. Even the prospect of being accepted at USC Film School didn't help. I'd be applying in the fall, but I wasn't banking my self-esteem on it. My identity was wholly self-created, and it didn't depend on teams or clubs or groups or schools or anything but me. All I cared about was making a name for myself as a writer. If USC could help with that, fine, but I wasn't buying any bumper stickers. This whole idea of a college experience, it filled me with contempt. I had no time for people who didn't already know exactly who they were and what they wanted. I could just picture them at Yale, in their bulldog sweaters, wandering around, having unique experiences that would slowly reveal to them their true passions, their true selves. God, I hated them for this. Because really, I envied them. Envied their freedom and choices and options. I didn't have that. For me, it was TV writing and being with Michelle. And if those things didn't happen, well, there was no plan B. But meanwhile, all these other kids, with their futures yet to be imagined, they'd all just show up at Yale and go to football games and parties and join secret societies and discover themselves on long weekends in the Hamptons, fucking in the moonlight on the decks of their father's yachts. I was unhappy. How did I get here? On the 4th of July, I had everything. And now as the summer slumped to an end in those long, hot, haunted days of August, my momentum had ground to a halt. Every day I didn't hear from those agents was a day I became more and more convinced that things were not going to suddenly go my way. I felt scared, diminished, lonely, and unmanned, pre-abandoned. And in these feelings, I was alone. Michelle was busy gearing up, packing large boxes with clothes that would have to be shipped, writing letters to her roommates she was still yet to meet, making final preparations to leave. Her exciting, bountiful future was eclipsing our shared past. Just as her new life was opening up, I felt like mine was narrowing to a close. The one question Rogo and Bayless still couldn't answer was the most crucial question of all. What was the energy that translated a dead person's desire to talk to us into an actual, literal, ringing phone? Well, another weird story brings us one step closer to a possible answer. And it happened to D. Scott Rogo himself. It is 4 p.m. on a Thursday afternoon in 1975. D. Scott Rogo is relaxing at home. He knows he has to put in a call to the UCLA Neuropsychiatric Institute, but he's procrastinating. You know how it is, and he just doesn't feel like it. 2 hours later, he still hasn't done it. It's bugging him. Maybe he'll just put it off until tomorrow. That's when his phone rings. It's the UCLA Neuropsychiatric Institute returning his call. What call, he says. The young research assistant says,
"The call you made at 4 p.m. today. I just found the message on my desk. It said you wanted us to return your call."
Rogo was beyond stunned. It was this very assistant he would have called if he had made the call, which he had not. He was later able to confirm this with his phone company. No completed calls had been made from his home that afternoon. Rogo says, This episode took place in 1975, only shortly before Raymond and I began systematically studying the phone calls from the dead mystery. In fact, it was this personal incident more than anything else that convinced us that the phantom phone call mystery deserved serious study. It didn't take us long to realize that these mysterious calls from the living represented a parallel aspect of the phantom phone call mystery. We started calling these intention cases, since they usually reflect an intention in the mind of a living agent, my own case being a perfect example. This is where the PK theory comes into play. Now, PK stands for psychokinesis, and for our purposes, it means a person's ability to affect physical matter with nothing more than their mind. I want to be clear that the existence of psychokinesis is controversial, to say the least. It is not a universally accepted phenomenon, even among parapsychologists. Now, there does seem to be some evidence that some people can use their minds to affect matter, most often on a microscopic scale. One way of testing this is through the use of a random number generator. A person will concentrate and try to impose some sort of pattern in the generation of numbers in a computer where otherwise there should be none. But macro PK, moving bigger stuff, real life carry shit, the jury is still way out. Some researchers have suggested that poltergeist cases are exactly this, a living agent unconsciously moving stuff around. But in those cases, there is obviously no conscious intention. In fact, usually quite the opposite. Intentionality, the will of a person, living or dead, to reach out and make contact with someone. To me, this could explain what happened with D. Scott Rogo. His conscious intention somehow manifested into a reality. Now this I can get behind. I've been trying it all summer. But can the unconscious desire to receive a phone call from a loved one produce the same sort of PK effect and result in a phone call from the dead? Let's look at what is called an anniversary case. A woman named Patricia Adams recalls this event from her childhood. It was Thanksgiving, and a large group was celebrating at her mother's house. Now, one of the guests, a good friend of her mother's, had lost her college-aged daughter 2 years before. As it turns out, the young woman was killed in an automobile accident on her way back home for Thanksgiving. So this year, while everyone was gathered and the grown-ups were all busy talking, the phone rings. And Patricia answers it. From the book, quote, "I heard the long-distance operator say,
'I have a collect call.'
She mentioned the name of my mother's friend, and she mentioned the name of the daughter. Now, this threw me a bit, even as a child, and I said, 'Just a minute.' I went and got my mother's friend. She came to the phone. I stood watching her, because I had heard the name and thought maybe someone was playing a joke on me or her or something. She listened on the phone, turned absolutely white, and fainted. Later on, I heard what happened. She had heard her daughter, who had been dead 2 years, speak to her. And she said the same thing she always did before she came home.
'Mommy, it's me. I need $20 to get home.'
This, as it turns out, was a long-standing joke between the mother and the daughter. And the mother always sent her daughter $20 for good luck. They called the phone company, but there was no record of any phone call. We've talked before about a subgroup of parapsychologists known as anti-survivalists. These people believe in many aspects of the paranormal, perhaps, but they don't believe in life after death. So the anti-survivalist, PK believer, and wasn't that a Monkees song? Would explain this last case by saying, well, it was the anniversary of their child's death, and their subconscious desire to speak with their loved one was so great that they somehow generated a phone call to themselves to satisfy this great internal desire. The only problem with this theory is that if it were true, shouldn't there be many more cases of these calls? I mean, so many people have lost so many loved ones that if PK were the cause, there would not only be more phone calls from the dead in general, but more of them would be of this exact kind. But there aren't. Why not? I don't know. If PK is involved in the phenomenon, then I would argue it's a force of internal will that is focused outward, not inward. As D. Scott Rogo's strange call to UCLA demonstrates, maybe PK is an arrow, not a boomerang. Your soul can make a call to someone else, but it can't create a call and then receive it. No matter how much you may want that one special person to call. Otherwise, what are we saying? That people can somehow manufacture the phone calls they most want to receive? Well, why limit to just phone calls from the dead? Why couldn't I create incoming calls from agent after agent after agent, all begging to read my A-team script? Life just doesn't work that way. Michelle left for Yale on Friday, August 26th, 1983. My last night with her was Thursday, the 25th, exactly 5 months after our first date. We didn't have sex that night, and that was fine. She was too stressed out, and I was too sad. We lay on her bed in her childhood room, surrounded by her model horses. We held each other. There wasn't much to talk about, and pretty soon, I knew I had to leave. She said she'd try to call me the next day from New Haven once she and her mom finally got in and were settled. I kissed her goodbye and felt like one of us was dying. I got out of there just before the torrent came. I sat in my car in the dark in front of her house, crying so hard it felt like throwing up. The terror of separation swept over me. It was a long time before I felt safe enough to drive. The next day, I sat alone in my bedroom in a stew of loneliness, depression, and deep fear. I'd waited for calls from her before, but it had never felt like this. I remember that day as endless. My room was like an oven. I didn't eat. I couldn't read. What if she doesn't call? What if she never calls? The separation from her felt suffocating. My room got darker and darker as night fell. I didn't turn on the lights. I lay on my bed, sweating, praying for the phone to ring. There was a soft knock on my door. "Can I come in?" It was my mom. "Fuck. Yes." She opened the door. "What are you doing sitting there in the dark?" I told her I was waiting for Michelle to call. "You don't have to do that," she said. "We can answer the phone. Why don't you go out with your friends? Here's $20. It was so clear that she and my dad had been talking about me and how sad I was, and this was their solution. $20. They were being nice to me. "Thanks," I said, "but I better wait, just in case." My mom looked like she wanted to say something about that. But instead, she just said, "Okay, well, here." She put the money on my desk. Her job complete, she withdrew and closed the door. And weirdly, I felt a little better. Like some internal instinct towards self-punishment had weakened its hold on me momentarily. Then the phone rang. And the feeling came rushing back. My stomach clenched. "This is Michelle calling. Why am I so afraid?" It was a feeling I would have many, many times over the next 20 years. I picked up the phone quickly, my fist tight on the receiver. It was Michelle calling from the New Haven Motor Inn on Wilbur Cross Parkway. She and her mom had finally arrived. They were exhausted from traveling. There were two stopovers. It was the cheapest flight they could get. I felt like I was breathing her entire self into my body through a thin reed. I held very still, like any movement would interrupt the flow of her into me. She was telling me that she and her mom just wanted to eat something and go to sleep. The dorms wouldn't be open until Monday, but they were excited to spend the weekend checking out New Haven and exploring the campus on their own. They might even meet up with some of her suite mates. Our connection wasn't great. Everything was 2 seconds off, like a film out of sync. There was silence while we waited for the other one to say something, then we both said overlapping I love yous, and then she said she had to go, and suddenly the call was over. I had waited all day. I kept holding the receiver, but there was no one there. Finally, I hung up. I realized I had been staring at the wall above my desk where I had taped a TV guide cover with the A-Team on it, next to a small photo of Michelle and I on prom night 100 years ago. If I had been able to create a phone call from her, it would have gone differently. She would have been sad, as sad as I was. She would have told me she'd made a mistake. She was catching the next flight home. That going to Yale wasn't as important as us being together. There would be no frustration, no fear, no cold realization that this call couldn't possibly be happening. She would tell me she was coming back to me, and I would believe every word. Thank you for joining me on Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf. Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf is presented by Astonishing Legends, 134 West, and Summerland Entertainment. Executive producers, Scott Philbrook, Forrest Burgess, and Susan Lambert. Our associate producer is Tess Feifel, and our sound designer, engineer, and editor is Kevin Ducey. Artwork is by Tommy Beaver, website is by Kayla Lord, and our music, as always, is by Nima Kazaruni. Please join us next time for a special bonus Patreon preview episode where I talk with ufologist Farah Urdozu, author of Love in an Alien Purgatory, all about supernatural events in her home country of Turkey, and we find out that not all ghosts and demons and aliens are the same. Anyway, it's a fascinating conversation. I hope you can join us. Until then, be safe and be well, find the light in the dark, and we'll see you again soon.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra-titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time for water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
You know that feeling when you're about to score 30% off, but they want your number? Ugh. Give them your Line 2 number instead. It's a second line on your phone, perfect for nabbing promo codes without inviting spam to your party. Sign up for every discount under the sun, then block the junk texts that follow. You get all the perks, but none of the spammy baggage. More codes, less chaos. Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store and get your shopping sidekick today. Because the only thing blowing up your phone should be good deals. Some matches are temporary, but your privacy shouldn't be. With Line 2, you get a second phone line just for dating. No need to share your personal number until you're ready. You can chat, text, and even block numbers, all while keeping things fun and private. It's perfect for online dating, blind dates, or just keeping things light. When you're ready to move on, Line 2 lets you cut ties without any drama. Dating should be fun and carefree. Line 2 keeps it that way. Ready to date on your terms? Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store today.
Ugh. Spam calls. Sound familiar? Introducing Line 2. Get a second phone number right on your existing phone. Imagine. Discounts. Appointments. Online forms. Handle it all without giving out your personal number. It's like having a secret weapon against spam. And when those unwanted calls sneak through, boom, blocked. No more interruptions, no more stress. Stay connected, stay protected. Keep your main number safe and out of harm's way. Ready to take back your phone? Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store today.
My fact this week is that Andy Warhol would regularly have his wig cut by a barber and then return the following month wearing a new, longer wig.
Hello, we are No Such Thing as a Fish. We are a British podcast all about facts and trivia and everything interesting in the whole wide world.
We cover everything from pufferfish rectums to the moon to mangrove forest. What else do we do, James?
Oh, well, what about the fact that in 1936, a robot in California shot its inventor in the head?
There you go. If you're intrigued to hear more, peppered with some bad puns and some crude jokes, then check us out. We are No Such Thing as a Fish.
Rakuten is the smartest way to save money when you shop, because members get cash back at over 3,500 stores across every category, including fashion, beauty, electronics, home essentials, travel, dining, and more. Your favorite stores like Lenovo and Wine.com pay Rakuten a commission for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the commission with its members, and that could be you. Cashback is deposited directly into your PayPal account, or if you prefer, Rakuten can send you a check. The choice is yours. You can even maximize your savings by stacking cashback on top of other deals, like store sales and coupons. You're already shopping at your favorite stores. Why not save while you're doing it? Membership is free and it's easy to sign up. Get the Rakuten app now and join the 17 million members who are already saving. Cashback rates change daily. See Rakuten.com for details. That's Rakuten. Your cashback really adds up.
This is an ad by BetterHelp. June is Men's Mental Health Month, and every year, 6 million men suffer from depression. If you are feeling overwhelmed, the strongest thing you can do is ask for help. And BetterHelp makes it easy. Take a short online quiz and connect from home with a qualified therapist. Visit BetterHelp.com to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com.
My fact this week is that Andy Warhol would regularly have his wig cut by a barber and then return the following month wearing a new, longer wig.
Hello, we are No Such Thing as a Fish. We are a British podcast all about facts and trivia and everything interesting in the whole wide world.
We cover everything from pufferfish rectums to the moon to mangrove forest. What else do we do, James?
Oh, well, what about the fact that in 1936, a robot in California shot its inventor in the head?
There you go. If you're intrigued to hear more, peppered with some bad puns and some crude jokes, then check us out. We are No Such Thing as a Fish.